Sam Cedar. Introducing whiny ass teeny baby conservatives to the truth. Wow, wow, conservatives. That's you crying. The left just got a little bit louder on The Majority Report.
It is Tuesday, February 15th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ushering in a new age of austerity where we have one party dedicated to absolutely destroying the middle class, creating a banana republic of sorts, and another party which is sort of not quite dedicated to that. Not totally. But we're certainly not looking at a two-party system where one party is representing the left in this country. We certainly do not have that. And you can call it capitulation. You can call it that the leadership of the Democratic Party, specifically the president, is a neoliberal. One can't say for sure, but we can say for sure what the end result is. Now, yesterday on the program, we had Dan Frumkin on, and he basically said there's a good chance we may get no budget. Republicans are saying it would be better to pass nothing than to pass Obama's budget, and I have to agree with them. Maybe a series of continuing resolutions keeping the government operation is the best case scenario. On the show today, we will be welcoming William Grider from The Nation on the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission's report, which came out, a couple of weeks ago now. And we never really had a chance to look at it. Of course, you know the end result. The end result is apparently nothing. It's a nice report. The Republicans on the committee that the commission decided to put out their own report because they didn't like the words Wall Street or fraud or derivatives being used in the majority report. But in the end, I don't think we're going to see anyone held accountable for the massive amount of fraud, the incredible amounts of irresponsible speculation that led to that financial meltdown. And then later in the program, actually in what will be within days, the part of the program unreachable, sequestered from non-members, we will be welcoming to the program a comedian, former co-host of Break Room Live, former host of Morning Sedition on Air America, Mark Maron, who tweeted yesterday that he's coming on only because I won't leave him alone. This is going to be an ugly. It's going to be an ugly interview. He will not be with us in the room, but he'll be on the phone. But there's a good chance he'll walk off in the middle of the interview. That I should tell you is my number one agenda. So let's jump right in. A little bit more on the budget. I don't know if I mentioned this yesterday. And, you know, look, I rode shotgun yesterday with Mike Papantonio for a couple hours on the Ed Schultz show immediately following this one. And I should also say, as a part of the house cleaning, that that Glenn Greenwald interview, we've clipped it. You can get the clip. You can embed it on your website. It is, it's going gangbusters. We had something like 500 or 600 people download that interview in and of itself. Never mind the thousands who, more. All right. Well, I haven't checked the stats lately. Never mind the people who the thousands upon thousands who download the podcast every day, or a day or two later, or 3 days later. Sometimes people, it takes 4 days until they catch up to the show. We provide you with that much content. WikiLeaks also tweeted out the interview. And the story is starting to get some mainstream attention. And we will talk about that as the show progresses. But I want to remind you that we are going to be sequestering the podcast in the next 2 days. I don't know if we're going to do it tomorrow or Thursday. Certainly by Friday, you if you have not become a member, you will not be able to receive the full 90 minutes of program. You'll still receive the first 40 minutes, which in and of itself, I guess, is a blessing. It's a wonderful 40-minute program. But it is your help, your sponsorship, your memberships that fund this program. 99% of this program is funded by members. Well, I should probably put that down to about 90%. And then 1% is our sponsors. And then there's 9%. Well, gosh, if I had to really rejigger that when I talk about labor, free labor, and reduced cost labor, not to mention my own for that matter. You can also support the show by going to Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop. Get some coffee, get some tea, get some chocolate, put majority in the coupon code, get 10% back. You can donate your Twitter account to us, which helps us get the word out, which helps us get more listeners, which hopefully will get us more members. You can cut out the middleman and just become a member if you haven't become one. But it's donateyouraccount.com/Twitter. And if you buy Amazon goods at our site, you go to the majority.fm, just click on the book and DVD section. And this is good for not just books and DVDs. There's a link at the top of that page. If you link there, you bookmark that site, and then whenever you buy stuff on Amazon, we will get a small commission. It will help us tremendously. And don't forget, as always, I will be on Ring of Fire this weekend with Bobby Kennedy and Mike Papantonio. Mike will be talking to people at Think Progress about this story, this massive scandal involving the Chamber of Commerce and involving many corporate interests. And there what appears to be lawbreaking or conspiring to do so. And the denials are flying fast and furious, but they can't keep pace. Like I said, the story has finally hit the mainstream media. Over the weekend, the New York Times did a piece, and now we see the L.A. Times, the Washington Post also coming out with stories. L.A. Times came out with one today. I don't know if they listened to my interview with Glenn Greenwald. I'd be surprised if they didn't. It would be journalistic malpractice on their part to not have. Hoping to win a lucrative agreement. Now, of course, see how they frame this now. They are already trying to figure out who's going to be the scapegoat. And they've all decided it's H.B. Gary. But remember, H.B. Gary is at the forefront of this story simply because that's where Anonymous broke in and took their emails. So the information is coming from their end. But all the other people who have sent emails that were part of this 71,000 email treasure trove have not denied that those emails weren't theirs. But they're going to use H.B. Gary as the fall guy here. So it's framed as hoping to win lucrative agreement with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, three data security contractors for federal defense and intelligence agencies. Remember, the tools that they were using to build this proposal, the tools that they were using to spy on Americans, including scraping Facebook and other social networking sites in violation of the law, were developed with money that they received from the federal government to track terrorists. So in other words, not only is the Chamber of Commerce and these corporations engaged in the same type of work we would engage against terrorists, violating laws in terms of privacy, planning to extort, to slander, to defame journalists and organizations,
They were doing it with our money. They were doing it with tools that we paid to develop.
Employees of the firms compiled short dossiers on just a few activists that included photographs, reference to their families, and charts of their relationships and with other liberal and labor leaders. Now, understand, they're framing it as if these three members of Team Themis simply got together and said, hey, I've got a great idea. Let's compile these dossiers and then approach the Chamber of Commerce through this law firm and see if they're interested in our services. That's not what happened, folks. The initiative went the other direction. Bank of America pushed to Hunt and Williams by the Department of Justice. Presumably the Chamber of Commerce also pushed to Hunt and Williams by the Department of Justice. They can take care of your needs. Hunt and Williams then goes and solicits Team Themis, these three cybersecurity firms, for what they can do for our client. And now we see, just breaking yesterday, a trail of emails explicitly showing that the Chamber was perfectly aware of what Team Themis was doing. Perfectly aware. They had seen round one of demos. In other words, here's a demonstration of what we can do. Well, let's see round two. Let's see what more you can do. Added. With no indication they had a problem with the round one demonstrations. In fact, every indication they were happy with what they saw. They wanted to continue down this road. But the LA Times, the Washington Post, they're not going to frame it like this. They're going to frame it as if these freelancers just jumped up and, you know, like that kid who shoots a Subaru commercial and sends it into Subaru and says, hey, do you like this? Let me shoot a commercial for you. That's not the way it worked. Chamber officials, as well as a spokesman for the Bank of America, said they knew nothing of the surveillance proposals until the emails were released Friday by Anonymous, a group that is sympathetic to WikiLeaks. And then, so they provide, understand, this is a classic PR tactic. This is a classic tactic by propagandists if you want to frame the story this way. First, you issue the denials. First, you present the denials. Then, you produce the evidence that suggests the denials are fake. Do you understand? So, if I say to you, we have emails that prove that the Chamber of Commerce and Bank of America knew what Team Themis was up to, but they deny it. That makes the denials seem a little weaker. But if I say the Chamber of Commerce and Bank of America have said they had no idea what was going on, but then two paragraphs down, like this LA Times story, but in some of the emails, employees of the security firms and lawyers in Hunt and Williams refer to contacts they had made with the Chamber about the proposed intelligence gathering. That's the story, folks. The denials are not the lead. The denials should come after the evidence that they're lying. But what can you expect? And like I said, officials of two of the security firms, Palantir Technologies and Barrico Technologies, confirmed the authenticity of the emails sent by their employees. But, of course, top executives had no previous knowledge of them. Because we all know that in these security firms, you have a lot of rogue agents who do stuff working with clients like the Chamber of Commerce.
Off book.
Yeah, of course. These aren't big, heavy hitter clients. We don't need to be paying attention to this. We had no idea. We're going to put one or two of these schmucks on suspended leave. And we'll make it up to them with their bonus at the end of the year. And like I say, Think Progress reports that leaked emails show that Barrico, Palantir, and HB Gary conspired to store information scraped from social media sites on Palantir's servers. What? What?
Hey, what happened?
I thought Palantir knew nothing about this. who then passed the scrapes with mugshots along to Parenteer. This is Facebook data about supporters and leaders of Change to Win, Code Pink, U.S. Chamber Watch, other organizations. Such acts are an explicit contravention of the legal terms of Facebook and, in fact, other social networking sites. All right, we got to take a break. We'll be back speaking to William Grider, the nation's national affairs correspondent. Later in this program, we will talk about the U.S. move to help internet freedoms around the world, except for America. And more on the draconian budget proposals from the Republicans and President Obama. And the continuing siege on unions, state workers, from day one of this program's relaunched in MR2, we've been talking about this was headed down the pike, and we're there, folks, and it involves the National Guard. We'll be right back after this. We are back. It's Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. William Grider, the writer for The Nation, national affairs correspondent, author. His most recent book, The Soul of Capitalism, Opening Paths to a Moral Economy. Welcome to the program, William.
Thanks.
So we have this Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, which was set up, I guess, to inquire into the financial crisis, and the results were, how would you characterize the results?
They did a very thick report, which is full of fascinating and sometimes shocking information. I wrote a piece which was expressed my disappointment that they didn't focus what they found in a way that average citizen could really grasp the enormity of what happened in the financial crisis, and basically the facts are in there somewhere, but you have a hard time finding them, that describe the kind of continuing fraud that was committed in the financial system by some of the biggest players, and their response to me was, well, you want us to be prosecutors, and that's not our job. Our job is to examine the history and tell people what we think the causes were. And they did that. Most of what they said is not much of a surprise. They blamed regulators. They blamed major banks. They blamed, careless traders, et cetera, et cetera. I'm one of those people, and I think a lot of Americans are with me, who believe that this crisis has not been resolved because a lot of people did things which are criminal, basically, and they ought to be prosecuted. And that hasn't happened except for the minor players.
Now, we know that the Republicans on this commission, in fact, there were two sets of Republicans that wrote sort of competing analysis of this. And I guess some of the problems they had was they didn't want the word derivatives and they didn't want the words Wall Street in their reports.
Right. So Republicans freak out at any suggestion that the capitalists did anything wrong. I mean, starting with the bankers, that just really chokes them up. The Democrats did a whole lot better, and they have a kind of, I don't know, seven or eight sort of major conclusions of what caused this. And they say, and I think they're right, that this crisis was thoroughly avoidable, that it involved people doing either wrong things or stupid things or blindly accepting behavior that they should have stopped. And I agree with that, But it seems to me that's not quite yet the whole story.
All right. Well, let's talk about the fraud. I mean, what do you think the major fraudulent the acts of fraud were that led to this crisis?
Well, we know the story in broad terms of mortgage-backed securities, right? You take 1,000 or 10,000 home buyers, and you take their mortgages, bundle them together, and then sell them not to a bank necessarily, but to investors as a security. You've got 10,000 debts in one package that is now worth hundreds of billions of dollars. One of the acts of fraud, which I think is now pretty obvious from what we've seen, is that the packagers, both the mortgage people who originated the mortgages and then the banks that bundled them together, ignored what they knew about the fraud, about the failed quality of those mortgages, either that they were done in ways that broke the rules, basically their own rules of what is sound lending, or they just dummied up the numbers and then took it to the credit rating agencies, which blessed them with AAA ratings, which was crazy now that we can look back on it. But the question of criminal action is hard to prove in finance. It always has been, because it really comes down to intent. Can you establish that the bankers did this with the intent to defraud the people they were selling the stuff to? And I think I grant that that's hard to prove, but there's a lot of hard evidence, including in this report, which could build a case from, because they did surveys and audits of their own materials. They discovered that, you know, large percentage, not all of them, but a large percentage of the third or so, were bad paper. You shouldn't sell them to anybody. And then they ignore that evidence and bundle them together and sell them anyway. Now, any normal person would recognize that's cheating, right? And it ought to be punished. Right now, there are hundreds, thousands of lawsuits underway, which are not the government, they're private investors suing the banks or suing the mortgage companies that did this to them. Some of the people are suing are big pension funds that bought this stuff, believing all of the assertions that these were good and safe investments and so forth and so on. And they're now trying to recover some of the money they lost. So if that's going on, where's the federal government? Where are the prosecutors? And I think, and I'm not alone, I think this is pretty widely shared, that they have been quite limp about running these cases down. Their argument is, well, we've got task force and we have investigations underway and so forth. But you don't know, it's now 3 or 4 years
right
since these things happened, and they ain't secret anymore.
Well, you know, it seems to me it's the functional equivalent of selling someone a car where the odometer says
right,
25,000 miles, and they have turned it back, or this is a car that they got from a flood and they cleaned it up and said, "There's, you know, this is a wonderful car." But wasn't there also a dynamic where in 2005 people became aware? To belabor this this analogy, that these cars had come from flood ravaged towns, or that these cars had their odometers pushed back, but still people were pushing these cars and selling these cars, and in fact you had people out there who were again, to belabor this analogy, pushing the sales of these cars because they owned car repair shops. So I'm talking about hedge funds, where you had
right,
people who were pushing these materials and then hedging their bets that these securities would fail, and you had guys like John Paulson making billions off of this,
and they had themselves a kind of inside role in the story with Goldman Sachs, which is really extraordinary. Is Goldman Sachs invites John Paulson to help them construct some of these mortgage-backed securities, and he picks the loan packages that are going into it, knowing full well that some of them, at least, if not all of them, are doomed. And then he goes out the day after and shorts the same securities. That is, buys a derivative or whatever that gives him a gain when its value collapses.
I mean, it's not just
you know, I'm not accusing John Paulson of a crime. I don't have the evidence to prove that, but it sure does smell bad. There are thousands of transactions like that. And I'm not unrealistic. I understand that the FBI and the Justice Department and others have been overwhelmed by these things, but I'm still troubled that there's just very few cases. And I'm digging a little further into that now, trying to figure out why hasn't this happened? And I'm not I'm not a perfectionist, but people in the financial world say pretty much the same thing, that there was massive fraud and the government has really not moved against it. I think one of the reasons, I don't want to prejudice my own thinking because I'm still reporting, but I think one of the answers is that first the Bush administration and then the Obama administration made the choice that they were going to do whatever they could to restore the banking system, particularly the big guys at the top, to good health, even though they were the institutions that had basically caused this catastrophe. Once they've made that commitment, it at a minimum undercuts any incentive they have to run down the crooks and prosecute them. You see what I mean?
Yes.
It's not necessarily that they're fixing things to let the bad guys go. It's that they're trying to restore these institutions. If you go after their fraud, you're undercutting the institutions. And my view is the government ought not to have that choice. You got laws that say this is a crime, prosecute the crime. And if that means collapsing Citigroup or one of these other big banks, so be it. That's, you know what I mean? The government doesn't let, you know, you go into court and you've been accused of some heinous crime. It doesn't allow you to make a plea of, well, if you send me to jail, I'll lose my job, you know, or my family will suffer if you send me to prison. You shouldn't do that. Nobody else gets to play that card.
And so what does it say about the likelihood this is going to happen again? Because if the message is that these banks are too big to fail, we're not going to prosecute any clear criminal activity. I mean, you know, you may not feel comfortable saying it, but when a guy picks which loans will go into this security, and then the next day shorts those securities, it seems to me that he has done that. He had that agenda the day before he showed up and picked those securities.
That point is very hard to prove.
I'm
not a lawyer, but any prosecutor would say, well, that may be true, but show me the evidence.
Right.
And
fair enough.
You know, I said in my piece a little playfully, but I'm actually serious about it. This kind of crime requires this sort of patient methodology that the FBI and other investigators use against the mafia. And they don't build those cases overnight, it's true, but they start typically by squeezing guys down below, you know, the thugs, right?
Right, and
you get them in a case that they are going to prison for. And then you turn them, and they become witnesses against the guys above them, and those guys become the witnesses against the big don at the top. I mean, I think the structure of the financial system has a certain similarity there. There are all kinds of relationships within the system that average citizen, if they understood how they function, would say, my God, that sounds like a crime.
Right.
And,
well,
and within the system, people say, no, that's just the way we do business every day. So there's a lot of that to sort through. And I think if they don't, to go back to your question, sooner or later, the same processes will lead to another kind of catastrophe. It won't look like the last one. It'll look different, but it'll be... I mean, fundamentally, if you don't enforce crimes that are, you know, at least demonstrably provable, then the people who do those crimes to great profit will do them again. That's
right.
Not
and
that
we've
complicated.
Made, I mean,
right?
Isn't it the case that we've actually made these institutions that were too big to fail, so much so that we couldn't prosecute these crimes 3 years ago? Haven't we made these same institutions even bigger, even much bigger to fail now?
Yeah, they became bigger partly because they absorbed their failed competitors. You know, Merrill Lynch went into what, Bank of America, and Wachovia went into Wells Fargo. I mean, it's and there, you know, a consolidation left you with a slightly smaller number of mega banks. You know, depending on how you count them, 7, 8, 10. But they themselves have a bigger reach over the entire market than they had before. It's, you know, it's up around 60% of all the finances in those firms, and that makes it even harder for the government to step up and say, you know what, you guys are just, you know, you got to get out of the game or get smaller, one of the two. But we can't allow this really a monopoly situation to remain and prosper. And the Congress and this president have not yet stepped up to that. What they did, in effect, was turn the problem over to the Federal Reserve and other regulators, the same folks, I would point out, that failed to stop this stuff the first time around.
Right.
And ask them to figure out how to prevent too big to fail. Well, I can say with real sympathy for those regulators, that's an impossible assignment.
William, I know
I think they know it.
I know you have to go, but when we're faced with a situation where, to use your analogy of organized crime, where the capos, at the very least, actually are spending most of their time at the White House or at the Fed, where possibly do you see any chance of reform coming from, if there is any?
I'm an optimist. If you read my stuff, you know that. I'm an optimist in the face of a lot of dreadful facts.
Why you're here.
I've been doing this a long time, and I've seen a lot of terrible stuff, but I really do have a kind of abiding confidence in the qualities of the American people. They will put up with a lot. They will get snookered. They will be lied to. They will be too lazy to do anything. And then all of a sudden, they'll raise up and pound the system. I think that's coming. I think, you know, we've seen little bursts of it so far. I think it's going to take. That's what it's going to take. I'm not prepared to suggest that we're in a pre-revolutionary condition. We're not, but we might be. And if people think about what happened in Cairo and Tunisia, it's an interesting question people should ask themselves. I mean, we are fabulously wealthy as a country. I mean, virtually all of us except the poor. And we live well, and the system makes that possible. So naturally, we're not in the desperate state that the Egyptians, for instance, were in. But other than that, there's a certain similarity, because you listen to what the people in the streets of Cairo were saying about their government, which has all the trappings of democracy, only it wasn't.
Right.
And I think Americans are slowly, painfully coming to face some of the same contradictions about ourselves. I believe that's true. And the first response is kind of cynicism and resignation, you know, throw up your hands and think about something else. But not everybody does that. And I think, and particularly, and here the parallel is really important. If this happens, this rising that I hope for, young people will be at the center of it. And I mean, you know, younger than folks like me, and younger by a generation or two. Because they see this reality, and they know that the institutions of politics are failing, and they know that the government is not performing, and they will have new things to say. And I look forward to that, and I actually have some confidence that's going to happen. Doesn't say it will necessarily succeed, but I think the efforts will be made.
Well, William Grider, writer for The Nation, National Affairs correspondent, from your mouth to whomever's ears is necessary for that to take place. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks for talking. Bye.
Bye. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. And we'll be back in a minute with some more news. And then later in this program, Mark Maron will be with us. So, speaking of that uprising, I feel like I should give a should probably give a student discount maybe in the future for a subscription to this program, for that very reason. I think I mentioned this yesterday. I'm not quite sure. Wall Street Journal reports that the White House retreated on the Social Security offer, so that was on the table. We know that, folks, and at the last minute it was yanked. And I think part of that was, frankly, the reaction of people like you. Letting your voice be heard, letting the White House know that this is simply a bridge too far. It's quite possible they may try and cross it later. Hopefully they won't. But the one thing you should feel secure about, folks, is that while we're hearing about cuts to home heating oil assistance for elderly and the poor, undoubtedly going to cause, I don't know, 1, 10, 20, 30 deaths because of a lack of home heating oil, undoubtedly will cause malnutrition in certain some kids, because parents will be forced to making a decision between how much food the kids gets and whether or not they're freezing in a house, whether or not it's we're talking about cuts to pregnant women and children nutrition, whether we're talking about cuts to Pell Grants, whether we're talking about a myriad of cuts proposed on one hand by the Republicans, which is draconian, and cuts by the Obama administration, which is just simply ridiculous in the face of a recession. And in fact, if you think I'm the only person who says this, let's go to one of the world's most famous economists, a neoliberal in his own right, in some respects, but one who can look with clarity at what's going on in this country and with shock. And, of course, I'm talking about Jeffrey Sachs, a Columbia University economist. He was on Bloomberg News, and he was asked about the White House and Republican proposals. And here's that sound now.
Both are completely unrealistic, in my view. The Republicans, way out of line, what they would do would be to basically destroy core government services. The president is reacting to that by doing something that just squeezes. And I find both of them very unrealistic. You know, the real story here is that in December, the Republicans and the White House agreed to give up $900 billion of revenues in the tax extensions, the extensions of the tax cuts. Then they turn around and say,
"You don't subscribe to the Laffer curve, I'm getting."
You better believe I don't, because history has shown what nonsense it is.
Now, the Laffer curve, I should tell you, and we'll start this up in a second. The Laffer curve is a theory that suggests there is a point in which you tax a population where it will cause diminished returns. This is basically an Ayn Randian Gowan-Galt theory, premised on the idea that if you tax people 100%, they won't work. Now, it's an absurd theory. Maybe, perhaps that's true. But I guess if you provide everything a person needs to live because of that 100%, they very well may work. You know, the old joke in the Soviet Union is the government pretends to take care of us and we pretend to work. But if you are talking in this theoretical realm of modeling, and you were to be taxed 100%, certainly people would work, I would imagine, well, I would think most people would work, I don't know, arguably less, because most people work in horrible jobs. Those people who work in those jobs that are very high-paying or are fulfilling would probably continue to work because they wanted to amass the power and the
But at the end of the day, if you are being provided with health care and food and housing and schooling and vacation and a trip to every citizen gets 3 weeks at the beach. We rotate them through, whatever it is. It's a ridiculous premise. But what's even more ridiculous than that, because we know this, we can test this out. It was less than 50 years ago when the highest marginal tax rate over several hundred thousand dollars was at 90%. And guess what? People still worked. So this idea that we are anywhere close to a percentage with the highest tax rate in this country at 33%, federal income tax, that we are anywhere close to the point where people are going to stop working is absurd. It's absurd. And Jeffrey Sachs makes that point. Let's continue.
And then they turn around, having given up nearly $1 trillion of revenues over 2 years, and say, oh, my God, we have a huge deficit we have to cut. So then you cut help for the poorest communities in this country. You cut help for clean drinking water. You cut Army Corps of Engineers, which can't build the levees to protect cities like New Orleans. And what's happening with this country? We give up massive amounts at the top in tax cuts, and then we turn around and we squeeze the poorest of the poor. We cut grants for higher education in the same month that the president tells us that's key for our competitiveness. But I don't want to attack the president, because, you know, he's flanked to the right by absolutely absurd ideas that would just take apart this country.
Professor, you think we should, though, continue then a lot of the federal spending at the levels we have it, but we need to raise taxes?
Yes, of course. Of course, this is absurd what we're doing. The rich have had 20 years of the greatest boom in the history of this world. There's more wealth in this city than one could conceivably count. There are more billionaires. There are more people that have sheltered all their income. And we're turning around and we're just going to keep driving down the poorest of the poorest of the poor. And that's where we are. This is a game that's going to come to an end in a bad way. Do we really have to have our own Egypt here in the United States? Or are we going to actually understand that we have a society where half the people have no voice in this country at all?
So there you have it. And the shock from this guy on Bloomberg. Wait, you're suggesting that we should spend more and tax to pay for it? What? You're suggesting we should put money into the economy and then try and raise revenue? What? It's unbelievable. I mean, how many people, from William Grider to Jeffrey Sachs, are talking about this country taking a lesson from Egypt? And meanwhile, the Pentagon's 2012 spending proposal is the largest request ever since World War II. You remember World War II? That's when the entire world was involved in a war. Defense Secretary Robert Gates already revealed the Pentagon will seek $553 billion in its 2012 Pentagon budget plan, the largest request ever. Unbelievable. He's going to cut $78 billion over 5 years.
Wow!
But those oldie folks, those little kids who need their heat, wham! Biggest winner, according to Ezra Klein, in the budget, that would be the Defense Department. And this is an interesting piece from John Walker at Fire Dog Lake. He pulls something from Seed Magazine, where Princeton professor Elizabeth Gould's insights that understanding how stress damages the brain
could eliminate the general mechanisms, especially neurogenesis, by which the brain is affected by its environmental conditions. For the last several years, she and her postdoc, Mirescu, have been depriving newborn rats of their mother for either 15 minutes or 3 hours a day. For an infant rat, there's nothing more stressful. Earlier studies had shown that even after these rats become adults, the effect on their developmental deprivation linger. They never learn how to deal with stress. Normal rats can turn off their glutamate system relatively quickly. They can recover from the stress response, but these deprived rats can't do it. It's as if they're missing the off switch. She goes on to say poverty is stress. One thing that always strikes me is when you ask Americans why the poor are poor, they always say it's because they don't work hard enough, or they don't want to do better. They act like poverty is a character issue. Gould's work implies that the symptoms of poverty are not simply states of mind, they are actually warp the mind. Because neurons are designed to reflect their circumstance, not rise above them, the monotonous stress of living in a slum literally limits the brain. This is the austerity that we're headed into, folks. And the question is, will the American public push back, or will they be anesthetized by watching TV or whatever it is and simply just wait for, I don't know, I don't know what they could possibly wait for. We got to take a break. We'll be right back after this. Show still available to non-members. You can become a member at majority.fm. Please do so, because by the end of the week you will not receive this portion of the show. On the phone, you may know him from his work on stand-up theater, something, what was it, short attention span theater back in, I don't know, back in the day.
Really? You're going to do this kind of intro? Really?
Oh, it's Mark Maron. Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm fine, Sam. What's going on? So this is the special part of the show. How does your show work now?
It is a live show that we do live.
Can I listen to it? Can my father listen to it?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I'm a little disappointed that your father hasn't already.
I'll tell him. He hasn't figured out how to listen to mine. I don't know why he would.
Well, yours is a podcast. Mine is also a podcast. Mine is, in some respects, twice as much of a show as yours because it's live and it's a podcast.
Oh, so you mean we're live now and you're in your closet or wherever the hell you do this thing. And then, like, you put it up later as a podcast. But if people want to listen live, they can listen live. And then this section of the show, as you're presenting it to me, is the part that's going to be special after next week.
That's right. It's still special. But it's just not going to be available to for free. You're going to have to become a member to get this part of the show, unless you listen live, in which case the whole show is live. But, Mark, let me start with this question. I think everyone who is listening is aware of WTF, your podcast. It's incredibly successful. I don't know if it's number 2 on iTunes or top 10 or whatever it is. But I would say, and I have said many times, that it is probably, I would say definitively, the most successful podcast in the history of podcasting that was not migrated or tangential to a traditional media outlet.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's nice of you, Sam. Thanks.
Now, let me ask you this. Are you not just a little bit embarrassed the lengths you've gone to prove to yourself that you're better than me?
No, I thought it was necessary. I don't have any issue with how much effort I put in to make sure that that I rose out of the bad relationship we had. You know, that happens after things break up. But I think you're doing fine. I'm trying to find your show now.
Well, I may have blocked your IP address. That was one of the things that we sort of set up from the very beginning. The show's going good. I understand you wrote a piece for the New York Post. Is that right? On Valentine's
Day? Yeah. You know what's weird about that is, like, you know, I got a few emails of, you know, the sort of like, how can you, you know, do Murdoch's paper? You're supporting a fascist. And I, you know, honestly, Sam, I didn't even think about that.
Well, was, of course, you know, not. You know, my book was with HarperCollins,
right.
Which is, you know, and I wasn't supporting him. He was supporting me.
took a bath on that. That's a better way to look at it. I just, you know, some editor asked me if I wanted to write a piece that was funny. I said, yeah, and, you know, but there weren't that many emails like that.
Do you miss doing a live show, Mark?
I do. I like doing live shows. Whenever I go on the road and I go, like, this is fun, because I don't know what you're going to say. I don't know what's going to happen, if there's going to be surprises. Who knows? So I miss that element of it. When I go on the road, I like doing the live radio. I just got back from Minnesota, man. It was difficult. I was at the Mall of America, Sam. I was at a comedy club in the Mall of America.
And did you find that it attracted too many American types?
Well, no, it's just sad to be, like, the Mall of America is like this weird sleeping giant. I felt like I was being, like, psychically pummeled by the collapse of consumer capitalism. You know, I found that in that moment when I was walking around the mall for the first time that like, I felt bad for stores. So, you know, that runs deeper than democracy on some level, that I was like, oh, my God, this is horrendous. And then on the weekend, you know, the parades of just, you know, weird displaced anger and need in the form of families who, you know, don't know how to fill themselves up properly, just kind of parading through. And there's a roller coaster in the middle that just screaming for help. The whole thing was just sad. And the comedy club, it was huge. It was like the size of a barn, and there was videos and twirling lights before the show. All the money in that comedy show went into dwarfing the size of the comic. You know, by the time I got on stage, you know, I must have just, you know, just like, I was just a little teeny person. Like, I couldn't, it was okay. You know, I had a good time, but man, it was.
How many people?
It seated like 300 or 400 people.
Did you sell it out?
Yeah, three shows we sold out.
Wow. So you're selling out shows all across the country now.
Yeah, people are starting to come, but I got to be honest with you, my people, who I think would also be your people to some degree, you know, we're slightly different, you know, I think, our people, but we do share some people. I mean, to go out to the Mall of America was sort of a big deal, and they sort of made it clear that, like, I wouldn't go out there unless,
right,
you know, for any other reason. But yeah, they're coming out. It's nice.
So this is probably the most successful period of your career, would you say so?
Yeah, in earnest, I think that is true. And I'm very thrilled that it happened because I did something in my garage. It makes me feel like a man.
What's been your favorite interview? You know, I haven't listened to all of them, obviously, and I have I've listened to probably, I don't know, a dozen, which is a dozen more podcasts than I've ever listened to in my life.
I've done 150 of these things now, you know, and I think that, you know, if I'm really looking back on it, there's very few interviews I don't like. You know, there are things that become emotional. Like in the recent interviews, the Dave Foley thing,
right,
was very emotional. You know, like, I'm talking to these guys for an hour and 15 minutes, and if I get engaged emotionally, it becomes sort of rewarding and a little interesting. It's like teaching me how to be a person. I really liked, Bobby Lee's interview was kind of surprising. I like when, like, people tell me things that I just never known. Jackie Cation was great. Mike DiStefano, I think, has become very popular because it was so deep and so heavy. You know, he chose to come on my show to talk about his being HIV positive. You know, and he's, you know, I don't know if you know Mike, but he's sort of like a Bronx guy. He's kind of an Italian dude. He's like a wise guy. And, you know, he's a sweet guy, and I've known him a long time, but he decided he wanted to talk about addiction, his wife passing away from HIV and his HIV on my show. And it was just interesting because he had so much peace around it. So that was pretty heavy and pretty human and blew my mind. But even people Paul
Tompkins?
No, he's coming this week. Paul F. Tompkins coming this week. Why am I spacing it out? I you know, my memory's gone. And the Louis C.K. interviews were right. Good. I liked a lot of them.
You know, I probably should have started this like you started.
Paul Scheer.
It seems like every interview you start is like, you know, we've had problems.
Yeah. Yeah, that happens. I mean, I think I'm almost through most of those.
Yeah, it's only been 150 interviews, though, right? I mean, you could probably.
Yeah, there's some.
Because you're just going through comedians, right? You're just not going through people in general. I mean, if you were move on to executives and just other people that you knew, you probably would have several years lined up. I mean, you'd have probably.
My own version of My Name is Earl.
Incidentally, Ross Broccoli, we spoke to him on the program last week. And he wanted me to tell you that he's not dead.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good.
Because he heard, apparently, the interview that you did with Swartzen. Is it Swartzen?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it sounded like you guys were talking about him like he was dead.
Oh, well, I'm glad he's still alive. I'd like to chat with him someday. I don't know if I could do a whole hour, but, there's a big thing.
Well, you could also just chat with him, not record it.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I don't feel like it ended well with him and I.
Well, that's the way you start off every interview with everybody.
I know, but you're right. There's a couple of guys that I just can't get on the show. You know, Rick Shapiro will not come on. He's decided that I did something. You know, some event happened in his head that involved me. And there's some people that, like, I mean, you know, there was someone, like, it was interesting because I can't really talk about, I can't say his name or anything, but I thought I was feeling cocky, you know.
I heard like, this story. You told this story on your show about some famous guy,
yeah.
Right? That you called. What's his name?
I can't tell you, but I was
Why?
Just sort of like, I was just sort of like, you know, like I'm the apology guy. You know,
I heard you talk about. What's the guy's name?
I just thought your audience might not have heard. And
well,
I
the audience, you're not contextualizing it because we don't know the guy. It doesn't make any sense. You might as well. You could be making this up.
Yeah.
Who's the guy?
Big thing happened today. I actually caught Boomer peeing in my garage.
Boomer?
Yeah, this was the first time.
Is that
this
your
is
cat?
Why he lives outside. No, it's my neighbor's child. No, I'm kidding. It's a cat.
So is that what you do? You move to the cat when you get it like a. Come on, dude. What's the name of the guy? Mark was
the
telling
guy
the story.
Who won't,
yeah.
The guy who won't come on my show.
Right.
Because he doesn't want to air his dirty laundry in public.
Right.
John Stewart.
Ah, all right, fair enough. I mean, I don't blame him. I mean, you know, he's a very private guy.
Yeah, you know, it makes sense, you know, and it was just one of those weird things where you realize, like, that whatever I'm doing here, you know, has its context, and he doesn't do interviews anyways, but, you know, and then also there's some things that need to be resolved in private.
Right. That's right. I mean, yeah, John Stewart's not in a position where he wants to air that dirty laundry.
There isn't any, really. It was just, I just wanted, here I thought that, like, okay, I'm the apology guy now. I'm going to apologize to everybody. And then there's some people that are like, yeah, I'm not going to do that.
Right.
You know, there's not a lot of dirty laundry to air. It's just like, he's not going to air anything. You know, he's busy. He doesn't do interviews. And, you know, frankly, he just didn't want to. And that's that, you know.
Well, that seems fair enough.
Yeah, and I'm on the phone, and I'm like, oh, I guess, all right, then.
You got to wait until you get a little bit bigger, until he gets a little smaller.
Yeah.
That's basically what's going to happen.
I don't know.
I mean, that could be a long wait. So what's next? What do you do next?
Oh, I've just been running around.
Today.
Oh, you mean in general?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to, let's see what's happening. I'm going to upstate. I'm going to Ithaca on Friday to do a show at a theater at the State Theater with Eugene Merman. Next week, I'm going to Wise Guys for one night on Wednesday in Salt Lake City, Utah. Next Friday and Saturday, I'm at Laughs in Kirkland for 2 days. We're going to be doing March 10th, we're doing two live WTFs in Brooklyn at the Bell House. I think the second one's already sold out, but the first one's going to be filthy and fun. It's got a Patrice O'Neill, Keith Robinson, Otto and George and Liam McEnany.
Oh, I was busy that day anyway, so that's all right.
No, come on.
No, it's all right.
Yeah,
it's
I don't know if the second show would have been good. We're going to have Hader and Armisen. And,
Don't know. Why
don't we do a long one when
guys.
I'm there?
Yeah, actually, you know, it would be great to time it because Who's the Caboose is getting an official DVD release. It's going to be on video on demand. And
boy, man, this has been a long and hard road for that movie.
I, you know, when I set out to make that movie, I wanted a movie that comedy nerds would still be watching 20 years from when we made it. And I just, the best way to do that is to release it 20 years after you make it. That's what I figured out. Rather than to make sure that the film actually has the ability to stand the test of time, just hold it back, and then you get credit for that.
You're so smart, Sam.
I totally figured out the code.
Man, you're so it's amazing the kind of the amount of thought you. That's really incredible.
Yeah, no, a lot of people do it the other way. I did it this way.
Smart man,
oh,
really
totally.
Smart. Yeah. And having them all printed up and not selling them, that was all part of it?
Yeah, that was a slight hiccup because I got that call. The best part is I got a call. I said, I'm finally going to make DVDs of Who's the Caboose. And so I go and I make like 800 or 1,000 DVDs. And then 3 months later, I hadn't quite figured out how I was going to actually sell them. Uh-huh. And then, like 3 months later, I get a call. Hey, we want to distribute Who's the Caboose? Oh, great. I just made the DVDs. No. We're going to want to make our own. Well, what do I do with the boxes of the DVDs?
You save them for another 20 years, and they'll be collectors.
You know what
they
said? Start a podcast. Give them out as a membership swag.
Oh.
And that's what I'm doing.
Is there anyone that listens to you that doesn't have it already?
That may be a problem.
So it's on Netflix, dude?
On March 29th, it's going to be released. It's going to be on, I think, Netflix, on video on demand, on like cable stations, on Amazon, on iTunes, and available as a DVD.
Okay.
With an all new cover.
Awesome. Well, that's great. Great news, man.
Yeah, thanks. You really drew that out of me.
Yeah,
I gotta say, you've gotten to be very good at the interviewing.
Yeah, it's almost like second nature for me now. That's wonderful about your DVD success.
who have you wanted on besides Jon Stewart that you haven't had on? I mean, besides Broccoli.
Like I'm trying to, I'm hoping to get Gary Shandling. I've been in touch with him. I think that would be great.
Yeah,
Albert
Brooks.
Interesting. I'd like to get Albert Brooks, but I have no way of contacting him. Can you get hold of him for me?
Unless he listens to this podcast, this live show, highly doubtful.
Yeah, I mean, there's some people, I've been doing it all on my own still and relying on friends. And, because I find that every time I go through management or publicists, people, they don't show up or something. So,
right.
It's still, I've got to get him through someone I know.
Well, what is a publicist going to say to somebody? Hey, Mark Maron's in his garage.
Well, you'd be surprised, who comes to the garage. If I can get Ben Stiller to come to my garage.
If you talk to Ben Stiller, you can get him to come to your garage. Because then it's like, okay. But, I mean, a publicist is never going to say, I'm going to tell this guy, where is it? It's at his garage.
Right. No, I get that. But, it does have some credibility. They can show them the New York Times piece or something. I mean, it's obviously something that's happening. I mean, at some point, people are going to realize that that the future of entertainment is in my garage.
I was going to say that New York Times piece was fantastic, and I'll tell you why. And I think you'll appreciate this. Because I saw your microphone. I fell in love with it. I talked about it, and then someone sent me one.
They sent you a Shure SM7?
I'm talking on it right now.
It's great, right?
It's great.
Those are the best microphones. Someone just sent you one?
Someone sent me one.
That's nice. Was it an extra one or a brand new one?
Brand new.
Wow, that is a supportive fan.
Oh, yeah.
That's
We've
great.
Got some very good fans. We don't get cookies and stuff like that. We don't want those. I know that's like you go on and on about you get your food. Speaking of which,
can I add something? Can I interject something here?
Yeah.
Not only do I get food, but I get someone knitted me socks in Minnesota. I had some nice gloves. I get CDs. We're branching out from food. And believe me, if I needed something, Sam, God forbid I needed another microphone. If I was in such dire straits that I was begging my audience for equipment, that that I would be able to get that from my audience. And I'm glad that they were there in your time of need. But I'm glad things are turning around a little bit.
No, that time hasn't gone. That time hasn't gone. It hasn't necessarily turned around yet.
No, but I do love those mics. Jesse Thorne is the one that turned me on to them.
It's a fantastic microphone. It sounds much better. I forgot what I was just going to... question from the audience. I'm checking mm-hmm. here my IM. How much weight have you gained? How much weight have you gained?
Oh, that's really funny. You know, I've been on the road for 3 days.
I got an IM machine here, and I'm just taking questions from this IM right here I'm looking at.
I have put on a few pounds, but I wish I were sitting next to you so I could judge myself properly by like how chubby you are. But like
fit,
I'm
very fit.
You're thin?
Yeah.
Why are things that bad?
Well, it's it cuts both ways. You know how it is. I don't want to go out and spend much money on lunch. We live in the dollar lunch.
But I mean, are you up at the house upstate and you guys are are you like, do you have a root cellar now?
We got a root cellar, like, yeah. Propagating grapevines.
Are you and Nikki and Myla, just saying like, are there discussions around like, if we had meat, this would be so much better.
We're having a lot of pasta.
Oh no,
there's a lot of pasta.
Do you need anything? Do you want me to send you a mic?
Yes.
Who's in the room with you?
I got two producers. This is a big operation.
Wow. Do I know those guys?
You know Dorsey. Dorsey, say hi.
Oh, Dorsey's there too.
How's
yeah,
going, man.
Dorsey, I don't think he can hear you. What?
I can hear him, kind of. Okay. How long has Dorsey been over there?
Dorsey's been here since the beginning. We've been doing this since November 17th or 15th or so. We launched, more or less. And Evan's also here.
Hi, Mark.
Hey. So Dorsey, now you've been working pretty closely with Sam since, what, November, a little before. Look, it's going to get difficult. What is that, December, January, February? All right, so right now you're thinking like, maybe this will be good, all right? And it seems to be working pretty well. But, man, I'm telling you, come June, dude, you're gonna be crawling out of your skin.
Well, let's face it. Like, Break Room Live, that thing, it took about 3 or 4 weeks before it was a problem. Right?
You're right.
I mean...
Yeah, all right, but...
Maybe
you're not me.
What's that? No. It's perfectly fine here. People get along. We're in a very small room. We don't have any of the amenities that we had at Air America. It's all good. It's all okay. We just need audience. That's all.
Yeah.
And members.
Wait, how's it going though? It looks like you got some people. No.
Yeah, we get a lot more downloaders than I thought. Not like, I mean, you get what, like 250,000? What do you have? 350 K a week?
I don't know. It's higher now. I don't know.
Higher than 350,000 a week?
Yeah, the last few weeks have been kind of high.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome. Well, no, we are a fraction of that, but.
But it's like you're doing a different thing, and you've got
Yeah, I'm not saying it with any type of shame, but we're it's not as accessible.
Could you say it with shame, please?
I'll save that for the phone call after this, where I talk about when I send you a list of things that we need here at the office, coffee grinder.
Okay.
All right. Coffee grinder, computers.
All right.
Some what?
I got this great new coffee maker, this
half
Aeroplane.
An
Aero something coffee maker is great.
Question from IM. Mark, did Mom enjoy you making Thanksgiving dinner this year, and was she disappointed you didn't bring the girlfriend again?
Oh, no, yeah. No, I brought a different girl, and that didn't go well.
Yeah, wait, so you broke up with the stalker girl, is that right?
Right, yeah.
How's that going? Can you really break up
with
someone
sad.
Like that?
It was sad. I had a lot of love for her, and it got too crazy for me. And yeah, I brought her to Thanksgiving, and my mom was like, she was concerned about things, but the meal was good.
Well, but is she still? I mean, is
no,
she?
No, she's not. She's minding her own business. I don't know what she's doing.
All right. Well, that's.
But it was hard because I really liked her. You know, it's like it's weird that you know, of course, the one of the more emotionally sort of crazy women to enter my life in the last 3 years. I somehow get attached with her and get connected to her, and it was.
Because usually you are the you. It's usually the reverse.
I think so, but you know, it goes both ways. But the weird thing was that I never experienced this breaking up with somebody because your brain tells you to. Like, you know, I was actually going against my heart, which was difficult, and it remains difficult to this day.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that.
That's all right. I'll be all right.
I know.
I appreciate your concern.
I know you will. I am her Matthew says, Jon Stewart did an interview with Rachel Maddow for a full hour. That's got to be weird. That's got to be
fine.
Weird. That's got to be weird.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know. Look,
well, because you got out of the politics thing, and then he gives the interview to Rachel Maddow.
Well, he, you know, I mean, look, I don't want to talk too much about him because, like, really, I thought, you know, he handled it very well, and it made sense to me. I'm not, you know, the kind of interview I do is not the kind of interview he wants to do, and that's that.
All right. I see you still going for it.
No, and
happens.
I think that, you know, like Rachel, you know, Rachel's going to be, you know, is going to respect boundaries, you know, talk about, have context. You know, context and boundaries are things I don't do well, neither.
When's Conan going to be on your podcast? Hasn't
I'm
he
trying to arrange yet. He was supposed to be on today, and then they moved it.
Huh.
Well, I mean, I was supposed to record it today, and but they moved it.
You got
to
go there?
No, I think he was going to come here.
Oh, really?
That was the plan.
Where does he do his show from?
He does it over in at Warner Brothers, right over in Burbank at Olive, on the Warner lot.
Is that show doing well?
He's doing great, man. I mean, that show is like he's so comfortable, and they're starting to do like kind of more interesting and provocative sketches. I mean, I don't know who's watching it, but it's kind of fun to go over there. The studio, it looks great, and I think he's pretty comfortable. I don't know. I had a good time.
Are they gonna
I
have
was happy
back?
To be back. Yeah.
They're going to have
took
you
a
back?
While. I think so. I mean, why wouldn't they? I thought I did pretty good, and you know, I had fun hanging out with those guys.
All right.
So why don't you get me up to speed on politics? What's going to happen in Egypt? What happens now? Keep it brief, though. Not too complicated.
Don't know. It depends on what the military does. But I think there was a lot of stuff that was unleashed that I don't know how easy it is to put it back into the bottle.
Okay. Now, all right. So what's going on with the Republican Party? Are they eating themselves?
Republicans are fucked up, but you know what's really becoming apparent? You know, like I'm seeing more and more people who are coming out, people who are not particularly, you know, known as liberals. Like I'm reading this one piece, and we're going to have her on, I think, Cynthia Freeland. You know, she's from MSNBC? Whatever. You know, she's talking about writing a book about how we now have plutocracy. This is a business journalist.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a lot of feeling that we have a real problem that's really can only be resolved at the end of the day by, you know, some type of revolution.
Really? Like a counter Tea Party revolution?
I mean, it's not even really about a Tea Party. I mean, it's more about sort of people saying, you know, enough is enough. I mean, we're going into this austerity program, which is from any major economist, any legitimate economist will tell you that what we're doing is about to tank the economy more, in addition to hardship on poor people. And
is there anything we can do? Is there anything I can do out here to start get this revolution going? Because
I would free advertising for this program?
For the Majority Report?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. What, is there more on that list?
Yeah, that actually is like the number one. I mean, I could send you a full list, but that would be a great starting point. Superfunk 72 said, interesting but weird conversation. It's hard to tell when you guys are being serious versus sarcastic.
you know what? It's hard for me too.
Right. This whole thing is like premised on a vaguely sarcastic premise. I mean,
right, so,
I invited you 3 months ago.
All right.
I mean,
am I done?
You've been busy. You've been busy. I understand.
I've been running around, and I didn't know how to. I didn't know your phone number for a while.
You didn't know my phone number?
I don't know. There was a problem with communication. I was getting tweets from people, you know, like your stooges were, you know, trying to bully me on my Twitter. You know, these cedar stooges poking around in my Facebook. Hey, when are you going to do Sam's show? Come on.
You know, someone said to me, sent me an IM a while back saying, I saw Maron after his show. I said, right. When are you going to go on Cedar's show? And he was just like, what would I talk about?
What is with these gossipy little, progressive girl people that you have reporting back to you with their gossipy little bullshit?
Well, wait a second. Now, the point is that, like, you'll come on this program, you won't say anything, you know, that could get back to Jon Stewart that would be problematic, but you got no problem saying that to other people about me.
Look, let me tell you exactly what happened. The guy came up to me.
I guess it's just because Jon Stewart is more successful in your eyes.
No. Listen to me.
And in everyone else's eyes.
I want to clear this up.
And by any objective standard.
Listen to me. This is what happened, because this is bullshit. Let me just tell you what happened. The guy came up to me after a show, and he said, when are you going to be on Sammy's show? And I looked at him, and I said, that's exactly what happened.
And you didn't say, what would we talk about?
Yeah, maybe I said, what would we talk about? And then maybe I said some version of, what am I going to go on there for? He's just going to, you know, beat me up and hurt my feelings.
Well,
and then I said,
he didn't say that in
what?
The IM.
IM. And then I said, look, I wish him all the success with this, you know, this little thing he's doing.
I'm sure Jon Stewart says the same thing about your podcast.
He did.
I'm sure.
There's
he said,
no
listen,
doubt.
I wish you all the success with your little thing that you're doing, but I'm not going to do it.
He basically said that. he did.
So you're just taking your rightful place, as far as you're concerned, on the Hollywood pecking order.
Well, look, I understand that. Look, we're doing something that's very, you know, we're all in the same boat.
Let me ask you this one question.
Let me just tell you, people who know us, if I tell somebody who knows us, who has watched us on television or watched us on the machine on the desk, if I tell them, if they go, when are you going to do Sammy's show? And I go, I don't know, and they really don't understand why I might be reticent, then they haven't paid attention.
Wait,
to our,
I don't
our,
know
our,
why I was sitting there. I don't know why you would be reticent. Now
well,
I'm genuinely offended.
Well. You were genuinely offended.
Let me ask you this. Have they taken your garage yet? Like, do you still do it? When you do it in your garage, do you still do it in your garage, or did they actually take and create a facsimile of it on some on some Hollywood set?
Yeah, I've now got an exact replica of my garage on the Universal lot.
You don't say to Conan, like, hey, come into my garage. Where is it? Oh, it's right next door. It's on the Universal.
He's on the Warner lot. I'm over at Lancashire. By the walk of over by the Universal theme park, and they've recreated my garage to a point where. I have a cat here named Boomer that isn't the real Boomer.
Right, it's an animatronic cat.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. The problem is, like when the tours come through, you know, they don't really quite, they don't know what this part of the ride is. So I'm not at a level of fame where I shouldn't be on the Universal tour, actually. But this was the deal I cut with them.
All right. Well,
I've got to clean the shark every 2 days.
Oh, you know what? I wanted to ask you just one more final thing. Why did you sound so defensive in your lead up to the Gallagher interview?
You mean the thing I did after, or the thing in the room?
Well, no, I mean, like, you record the beginning of the show after you do the interview.
In that, why did I feel defensive in that?
Yeah.
Because I didn't want it to go the way it did. I don't know why it did go the way it did, and I was genuinely surprised that he did what he did. But I knew that if I was going to put it up, I needed to contextualize it, because I don't think I contextualized it in the interview, which might have been my one mistake, was to at least source the
That was the problem. That was the problem.
Yeah. You know, and I don't even know if I did that in the thing I added. But I chose to put it up. I don't have any, you know, regrets about it. It didn't seem as heated. Like, when I was sitting there with that guy, you know, from the beginning, You know, I'm able to be respectful. I have been respectful to people that I may or you know, have let you know less. I may not respect everybody that I talk to in the same way. And this guy came to me, and I really don't have much respect for him at all, and I never really have. So that was a problem. But then when he showed up, you know, he was an ass. I mean, he was a belligerent douchebag from the second he walked in. And then it made me defensive. And then after a certain point, when he started, you know, basically saying that the type of comedy I do, you know, is not real comedy, I couldn't. It just, you know, it was like, you know how it is, Sam. You've argued with people before. But I didn't think it warranted him doing what he did, but whatever.
I thought it was a great way to end the interview, and I was sort of hoping that we would get a little bit of that on this one. But sadly, our time is up, and I cannot offend you enough.
I think we've learned how to absorb each other's jabs.
Remember this? Old Maron Cedar thing? Oh, you can't hear it. Oh, all right. All right. Well, Mark Maron, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, congratulations on this little thing. It seems to be going well for you.
Yeah, good luck on your fleeting podcast thing, iTunes. It's going to be...
Bye, Sam.
On the way down, it's going to be really fun to watch.
Bye.
Bye, Mark.
What?
All right, bye. We'll talk to you later. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. That
let's
was
do it
bad.
Again. I had a good time. I'm going to tweet that I was just there. All right,
okay,
bye.
Great. I'll talk to you later. There you go, Mark Maron, folks. All right, I will take some IMs, and I'm going to get to this story about internet freedom tomorrow. That will make sense. It's a hilarious story, juxtaposing what America wants to do overseas and what they're doing, well, on our very own continent. All right, Kev, here's a way to cut the deficit. Eliminate one of four armed service branches. Corporate America has been merging, downsizing for a decade. Eliminate the overlap and cut one of four service branches. You know, let me just go back to that for one second. Where's my budget stack of stuff here? Hold on for one second. I can't quite find it. Oh, here it is. One figure that jumped out on me that Ezra Klein mentioned. In terms of the military budget. Let's see. If there were equal cuts. Okay. The military made out quite nicely in the 2012 budget. The administration is cutting $78 billion from the Defense Department's budget, known as security discretionary spending, over the next 10 years. Compare it to the $400 billion. This is Obama's budget, not the Republican budget. $400 billion they're cutting from domestic discretionary spending. Education, income security, food safety, environmental protection over the next 10 years. And keep in mind that the domestic discretionary budget is only half as large as the military's budget. So if there were equal cuts, the military would be losing $800 billion. $800 billion. Military spending is one of the least popular categories of federal spending, but we still don't do it. Do we really need a defense budget that is twice the size or greater, I should say, than the entire world's countries, nations, military budgets combined? Twice the size, at least, of China's? I mean, what is it? You know, and what are we doing with that military budget? Making a foreign country safe for our corporations to go there, become multinational, and keep their profits from being repatriated in this country. It's stunning. It's stunning. And this is just the beginning of the austerity. And we're not even talking about the cuts that are taking place on the state level. And we have right-wingers, right-wing governors out there threatening to use the National Guard so that if nurses or teachers or public works workers decide to strike, the National Guard will come and knock their heads in. That's where we are today. Where will we be next week? It's stunning. Nefertiti, sound has been cutting out all day, FYI.
Yeah, I'm talking to Kyle about it now. We need to do some server maintenance, but he kept everything stable for Aaron.
Okay. Fisher Stevens, ask him if anybody been willing to pay. John Stewart doesn't talk to his own father, let alone you, Maron. The latest show with your friend Tom Sharpling was very good. Oh, yes. I've heard good things about that Sharpling interview. Tom Sharpling, of course, the among other things, now he's directing a music video. He's done all sorts of things. Big writer for Monk. He was the head writer for Monk for a long time. But also the host of The Best Show on FMU, which gave birth to the original Majority Report in February of 2003. Ask Mark if he would ever do a morning sedition bits, only WTF. I Defeatocrat, in answer to Marin's question, I don't have Who's the Caboose, how do I get it? Wow, it really drives him nuts that a listener sent you a microphone, a brand new one even. Well, you can, there's a couple of different things you can do. You can become a Majority Report member if you haven't already, and choose that as your swag bonus. Or wait until the 29th and buy one from Amazon or iTunes or your local store or something like that. Drive up sales. Bush and Chains, how does Marin get a woman if there's no teenaged interns in the office to hit on? Shoot. I should have read that to him. Kansas Representative Connie O'Brien says she can tell who is illegal because they have olive complexion. There's a couple of stories I have for tomorrow. There's also a law that I think they're trying to pass in one of the Dakotas. Is it North Dakota?
South Dakota.
South Dakota, where it would essentially make it legal. It would be a mitigating defense to murder. If you killed a doctor who performed an abortion on someone who you were related to.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd, lay, hoddle-lay, hoddle-lay, loud was the voice of the lonely goat herd, lay, hoddle-lay, hoddle-loo.
Oh, holy, holy, oh, oh,
Cry Pop Phil. Mark, I got your damn number weak excuse. Oh, I got, oh, it should be more. Mark, I got your damn number weak excuse. Sam, a side note from making Mark grind his teeth tonight. Keith Olbermann is just up the street and not busy on a lark. Do you think you could call or tweet to see if he will come on? Connect with someone he follows on his Twitter and see if they will direct message him? Maybe I should invite him. I mean, my assumption is that he wouldn't come on, to be honest with you. Just because, why? But yeah, maybe, it's just. Turtle Girl, 72. A, when is Sam going to do Mark's show? B, nothing. Well, I've done, like, little guesties on his show, and I did a live show that apparently was, like, a, you know, I think it was a premium thing only for them, but maybe we should just download it and play it. Just start to mess with his IP. We should do that. Pull the whole thing and just put it on as a bonus on this show. That would actually be really super funny. Like, I wonder, like, he would get so mad. I could just buy his premiums, right, and then just put them on. That would not be funny. It would be funny, but it would, the only time it would be funny would be the first time you find out. Actually, maybe what we should do is we should this is what we should do. We should make a mock page on the website, pretend it's members only can download it, just put no links, like just put a GIF that says, like, for members only, listen to Sam. Here are all of Mark Maron's premium podcasts for free for members, and just make it like unclickable. So we just put that page up, and then we get somebody to email him and say, Cedar's giving out all your premium stuff to his members. Here's the link, and have him go to it and click, 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 and nothing happens. That would be a long way to go for a practical joke. But if somebody wants to set up that page.
Well, what are we? We're coming up on April. We can.
That would be a great April Fool's joke.
We can do
that. All right. Listen, I'm trusting all of you people not to say a word to Maron before this. This will be our April Fool's joke on Maron. We'll set it up like a couple of days beforehand.
And that way everybody can tweet to him like it'll be a mass tweet. Like, dude, he's giving away your stuff. Then
he'll freak out. He will totally freak out. But we need to, listen, well, we'll plan this later because I don't want everybody doing this like immediately on April 1st. That won't work because they'll know it's a joke. Would you have Phil Hartman's brother Paul on the show? Asking Maron, how would Paul Hartman get on your shows? Here's his Facebook. I'm enjoying the fine line between sarcasm. Mark is your Jon Stewart. Come on, you guys, kiss and make up. I like you both a lot. Have Mark back soon. Says Torino number one. Super Funk. Where can I find that clip of the Economist interview on Bloomberg? Where was that clip?
That was just on YouTube.
It's
part of an 8-minute clip. I can put a link to it.
Yes, please. We'll put a link to it on Majority Report, majorityfm.fm. Mark in Egypt, two examples of the revolutionary power of the internet, toppling dictators inside heads and inside countries. Wow, Sam, you and Mark, for at least a couple portions of that, were actually speaking and listening to each other. I'm not sure that's ever happened before. You're going to be on a show now, right? Well, I've done a little bit on a show. Yeah, you know, look. Do you not remember the old, like, Maron v. Cedar shows? Those were quite good. The problem, you know, became when it was sort of more narrow and Mark felt uncomfortable with the format. And I was just happy to, you know, once it became clear that Air America was going to go down the route they were, thinking that we were making a TV show as opposed to making an internet show or a radio show, I knew that we were doomed anyway, so...
Some of my favorite stuff from Air America's days were the Maron v. Cedar when you were at the DNC and he was in L.A. Those were great stuff.
That was great stuff. We used to have some great – we were doing that while I was upstate, and we would do it every Tuesday. And I got to see if there's a way to get those.
I have a couple on YouTube. I put some up on the Air America site. I'll post them on the Facebook. They're kind of funny. There's one – I think I showed it to you.
But, I mean, we had, like, I think, like close to 50.
Yeah, I don't think that they archived them in any. Like that.
No, I know Air America because we weren't doing it with Air America.
Yeah.
I got to see if those files exist anywhere. Maybe they got all erased. Sadly. Bob Flave, your podcast and website went down twice before Maron came on, so all the tweets paid off in listeners. Great show. I forgot to mention this, where it says click here for Amazon. It really isn't a link. I tried it when I bought something the other day. If I missed it, make it more visible. Thanks. Yeah, we'll do that. I'll go in and make that a button. I don't know where you are in the interview. I can't hear this until tonight, but I figure it's broken down by now, says Film Flesh Guy. So I'll say both you guys are right. Don't fight. Pluger, Majority FM website having issue today. Swamped by Maron Stalkers, alternate name for members only post show. The Majority Report Confidential. Flip side seems too common, generic, lacking branding.
Actually, yeah, we're getting a lot of listeners from Maron's tweets, and that's what's...
Oh, is that really what it is?
Yeah.
Ew. That's what you don't want to have happen. I'm happy now. I think it's easier to have a protest against a despot than it is to protest a whole system propped up by an ineffectual president. He's the nice guy who keeps the masses intact with the illusion of democracy. You know, I got to say, they certainly know how to co-opt us. Is the show over that abruptly? Sequester the Sammy Cam with sound for members. Dropped 5 times today. Yeah, I know. We've had problems. 2 things. See Glenn Greenwald link to the audio and transcript from yesterday's interview in his column today. Avant. My God. Every time, man. Every time I feel like I need to do this. You realize Avant spent hours making a linkable transcript, a transcript of that interview with Glenn Greenwald. It was a 30-minute interview. And I cannot thank you enough, Yvonne. I don't know what to say. You know, I think all the interviews we do on this show, I like. I'm happy. I can't even think of a couple of interviews that I was unhappy with. There's some I think are better than others, but that interview actually is an important interview. I mean, we made some news with that. WikiLeaks tweeted it, for gosh sakes. And it's an important interview, and the clips, the transcript is going to, people are going to link back to it because of that transcript. That is the currency of the internet in many respects. And I cannot thank you enough. Obama got a copy of Griftopia by Matt Taibbi from the American Booksellers. I know who Matt Taibbi is, Obama said. He sometimes doesn't have very high opinion of me. Okay, Yvonne. How do you suggest people refer to the H.B. Gary Fed story? H.B. Gary Federal Gate doesn't have a good ring to it. I'm also thinking there's some reference in those emails to an RFP, request for proposal, from Hunt and Williams regarding the project, which will be the smoking gun. You know, that's a good question. I think people are calling it Chamber Gate, which may be the best way to do it. You know, because our news media is so retarded and our population is so retarded that if we don't put the word gate on the back of it, people don't understand that it's a scandal. And saying corporate DOJ chamber terrorist spy tactics with our tax dollars scandal is just not sufficient. This thing could be so sort of big in a way that it might be one of those things that the media just can't digest. Because it's already confusing insofar as that there are actually two separate scandals here. H.B. Gary, Team Thesis, these three different organizations, prepared dossiers for two separate clients that we know of at this point. The Chamber and for Bank of America in two separate contracts, essentially. And it's conflated because all of this came from one email source that we know about, H.B. Gary Federal's email dump by Anonymous. But there's actually two that we know of at this point. Now, there's 71,000 emails there. My guess is there's going to be other stories like this. I mean, Fire Dog Lake has been putting these emails in sort of like a searchable database, I believe. And I imagine other people are working on that as well. And I imagine if you start putting in random companies in there, you'll start to see about corporate scrubbing. I imagine if you look for other organizations, I mean, who knows what search terms you put in there and find. It'd be interesting to put Acorn in there. Janet Scapin, I remember passing John Stewart on 6th Avenue the night you autographed Fubar at the Strand for me. Good, he's rich. He's rich. He looked completely unhappy. He's always been a nice guy to me. I haven't actually spoken to him probably in 6 years, but I saw him. I think I've told the story before, but we did the election night coverage right next door to the Daily Show, and I was outside, I don't know, just taking a break. And I think he was outside. I don't know what he was doing outside, taking a break maybe. And I was wearing my bow tie because that was what I was doing in those days to confuse people to think that I was Tucker Carlson. And this was after he had shat, just after he'd gone on Crossfire and shat on him. And he's like, oh, sorry about that. I'm like, dude, I'm doing it as a joke. Don't be a putz. Hopefully Marin isn't listening to this, but just between us, Mark is not aging well. You look exactly the same in the BRL days. Mark has grayed considerably. I got news for you. Mark grayed me during the BRL days. I've told this story, right? Where Marin came up to me and he's like, Carl thinks that you dye your hair. This was like in October or September. And I'm like, I don't dye my hair. I said, if you look carefully, you can see gray. Now, you don't have to look carefully. And I haven't grayed in a bit since I finished that run with Marin. He drove me gray. Trip. Cedar backside. Been done. Chamber of Commerce gate, says Trip. I think we may end up calling it just the, I don't know if we should brand it Flipside now. I'm thinking members only. Because that really makes it clear what it is. Yeah. It's for members only. Or maybe we call it, I don't know. You know, Flipside, I like referring to it as the Flipside. Like, I'll catch you on the Flipside. Meet me on the Flipside. For the members only show. Majority Report backfill. Call it members only jacket. Oh, yeah. I like that two daddies got along today, says Dan Wally. Hyperfill, Majority Report back. Phil, Bush and Cheney, so much for Assange being anti-Semitic. Dershowitz joins legal team for WikiLeaks. I saw that. Yes, in protecting Twitter. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Superfunk, Sammy privately plays with members. All right, folks, we've gone way over today. Remember, become a member. If you've listened this long, you're really going to miss it when you haven't joined as a member. We'll see you tomorrow on the program. Heather Hurlburt will be talking to us, giving us an update what's going on in Egypt. Until then, adieu. Don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. Shifting in and out.